All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
This week on Meat and Three, we have stories about food in large quantities. From bulk buying groups and reasons for stocking up, to creative solutions for handling excess waste.
We have someone picking up our corks from the wine bottles, and they repurpose them to make buoys for boats and like shoes and all these different things.
Yeah, because of the COVID, everybody isolated at home. But to see the people face to face is still exciting. So we kind of treat it like a chance to say hello to the people and to the friend.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcast.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your lone co-host this week, Ethan Frisch. And our guest is John DeBerry, co-founder of the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, author, mixologist, just an incredibly interesting and accomplished person. John, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for that very flattering intro.
So let's get started with the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. It's a fairly new organization. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the origin story and how you came to start it?
Yeah, actually, origin story goes back to late 2016, actually. And sort of like a moment of post-election kind of trauma, seizure, whatever you want to call it, led to a conversation, a text message conversation between a former Momofuku colleague of mine. Her name is Alex Pimoulier. Just kind of, I don't know, sort of spitballing about like ways to like increase and aggregate and organize the kind of power of workers in the restaurant industry. And, you know, seeing that it's such a huge population and that there's so much economic contributions that are made from the restaurant industry to our society, and not to mention emotional, cultural contributions, that there really needs to be more of a unified voice for restaurant workers, for the needs that they have particularly. And so we wanted to kind of see what we could do to help move things in that direction. And we had some sort of like weird ideas that didn't make a lot of sense from a legal perspective. And then fortunately, I'm married to a person who is a philanthropic professional who has been in that profession for over two decades, my husband, Michael O'Malley. And I kind of explained what I was talking about to him. And he says, well, this sounds at all like a community foundation. And a community foundation is a kind of a subgenre of the broader foundation kind of model, in that foundations are primarily grant-making entities. And so they basically give money to other organizations to do work. And that's kind of the function of a foundation. And usually it's the foundation starts with money that's been endowed, like a large family or, you know, whatever. But with community foundations, they start with basically nothing and they raise all the money that they then grant out. traditionally the community foundation model is used in for like geographic regions or populations like women, LGBTQ. But for us, it's the kind of first time we've seen it used as to address issues for a labor segment. So kind of a cool application of that. And we wanted to address kind of the quality of life crisis that we're seeing in the restaurant industry that now is very hard to ignore. It's been thrown in everyone's faces very suddenly and very extremely in the pandemic. But these are issues that have been plaguing restaurant workers for decades, if not centuries. Low wages, you know, racial injustice, gender inequality, mental illness, substance abuse, exploitation of immigrants, you name it, every kind of like social issue that we face is kind of magnified in the restaurant industry. And we wanted to help address those issues by giving grants that from the money that we raised. We want to also do our own advocacy and community building work. And then we also wanted to get into some impact investing where we would provide capital to businesses that were aligned with our mission and give them ways to get going and to get started. So that from that kind of nugget of an idea, we spent about a year and a half working on our 501c3 application and getting incorporated, thanks to the Lawyers Alliance, which is an amazing organization in New York City that provides legal assistance to organizations that serve low wage populations. And we had our launch in 2018. We had a little kind of coming out party where we told everyone what we were doing, and we had did a few grants based on some money that we were able to raise from our board. And then 2019, we kind of considered our first official year. We participated in a couple of fundraisers. Negroni Week was a big one for us. The response to that was really amazing from restaurants actually all over the world, oddly enough, wanted to participate and help us out, which was really validating. And we also had an in-person party in September where we were able to raise around $18,000 through raffles and other activities. And all in all, we raised around $40,000 last year. We were rightfully very satisfied with that as of year one. And we kind of projected to maybe double, maybe triple that this year, all things being normal. But then the pandemic hit, and in March, we knew that there was a need for some kind of specific response to this. So what we did is we had an emergency meeting of our board on Sunday, I think it was March 15th, and we came up with the concept of the COVID-19 Emergency Relief Fund that we would raise money within, and that money would go to direct financial assistance to restaurant workers. It would also go to nonprofits that were doing relief work for the population, and then we'd also establish a zero interest loan program to support small businesses through this. And since then, we've raised around $7 million in the fund, which is pretty wow. Staggering and impressive, and not something we ever thought a number we'd ever see, for many years. But I think if there's something that's gone on in the pandemic, is that things that were kind of already in motion were very much accelerated by the pandemic, and this is no different. So we've experienced a massive amount of growth in the last 6-8 months, which on the one hand, it's like, you get what you wish for in terms of being valid as an organization, but then again, it's like the reason why is very distressing. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but it's very great to be able to have a chance to be part of something to help alleviate some of the suffering.
Yeah, I mean, it's we at least we in the industry know that a lot of the issues that have come up since COVID are not new to the industry or to the people who work in it. These are systemic problems that have existed for a long time, and it's sort of mind-boggling given the number of restaurants and the number of workers in the United States that there haven't been more successful efforts to organize. Or if there have been, they've been very local. Why do you think that is? What has prevented restaurant workers from organizing to advocate on these issues before now?
I think there's a lot going on. You just kind of alluded to them. So I think, one, kind of on a structural level, restaurants are kind of small and local, and the kind of amount of consolidation that happens isn't quite the same as, like, say, the airline industry, where there's, like, you know, a bunch of huge corporations and then, you know, nothing else really. Whereas it's a really small informal economy of very, very small businesses, also very large businesses. So there's a really big dispersal of kind of the size and the ability to sort of, organize and kind of aggregate any kind of advocacy efforts. I also think that because of the nature of the work, it's kind of considered to be, you know, lesser work, undesirable work that's done primarily by women or immigrants or Black people or people of color, has been traditionally assigned to those roles. So there's kind of an inherent bias, like in a white supremacist society, to think of people who work in the service industry as somehow lesser and less deserving of the protections that other people get, and the wages and everything that, you know, come with having a job, and trying to survive. I think that's a big part of it as well. And, you know, I think those are the two, sort of blanking on anything else. I mean, those are two huge issues as to why, why this is happening.
Well, I guess what
allowed to continue.
Are there ways that you're approaching it that sort of draw on that history of a lack of organization, or like, how are you in building the foundation? How are you taking those dynamics into account?
Well, I think it really, I mean, for me personally, my kind of, one of my motivating factors for going into this and starting this was the fact that I don't want to discount the people that believed in me and in my own whatever talents, as such as they may be, but I had it really easy in the restaurant industry. And I was kind of, I waltzed into a lot of opportunities and I was able to capitalize on them and succeed because of that. And yes, of course, there's an individual component to that. And everyone works hard and does their thing. And there's also a systemic issue. And I just saw, as working in the restaurant industry for 10 years almost, that there was really a lot of structural imbalances. And I kind of saw them, like, firsthand, not as a, you know, a subject to them, but it's kind of as a benefactor of those things, that this really wasn't a great way to be, both from, like, a kind of moral human standpoint, but also from, like, a business standpoint. A lot of these things that people are advocating for aren't kind of inherently hostile to success as a business. And in fact, a lot of the things that we do to alleviate quality of life issues lead to greater retention of employees, which actually is probably one of the most expensive things you have to deal with, is, you know, losing and retraining employees and, you know, losing all that knowledge and having to recruit and all the time that wastes. So taking care of people is not only just the right thing to do, and we want to help people be able to learn how to do that, or, you know how or have the tools. But it also helps the industry just be better. You know, if you've ever been to, I don't know how common this is, but I feel like when I go into a restaurant and the people who are working there are just, like, really just in a great mood and everything just seems to be nice, it doesn't really matter to me how good the food is or even how good the service is. There's just something really nice about going to a place where there are people who are joyful. And you go into a restaurant and everyone kind of looks panicked and sad, like, it has, like, a real impact on your experience. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily connect that, who are kind of guests or patrons of the industry. You know, there's, kind of think of it as like a transaction of, like, you're just putting food in front of me and I'm going to eat it and it costs this much money. But the emotional labor and the kind of theatrics of restaurants, even restaurants that aren't fancy, is really important. And it's been, I think, traditionally overlooked as not quote work. You know, when someone comes in and you have to be nice to them, even though they're not that nice to you, like, that's work, that's labor. And people don't think that they have to pay for that, but they should. So it's really about just advocating for the humanity of workers in the industry.
Yeah. And really baffling that restaurant owners for so long have not understood that. I mean, this exactly is one of the reasons that I left kitchens, because there was always sort of, not always, but often, an antagonistic relationship between the ownership and the employees, where you would think that everybody would want everybody would want a relationship that was mutually supportive, that everybody benefited from, that everybody enjoyed, and that wouldn't have been that hard to set up. But there's something about the systems within the restaurant industry in particular, maybe other industries too, I guess, but seem to encourage that in antagonism, where owners are looking for ways to skimp and cheat and undermine, and employees are looking for ways to, you know, do the same back to the owners, because that's the dynamic that's been established. I've always been baffled by this issue in the restaurant industry, where it seems like it would be pretty obvious to everybody involved that there's a better way to do it, but people have not done it in most cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to respond to that, I think there are more often than not the issue of like the ownership versus, you know, employees versus labor is sort of more a matter of like incomplete information and kind of not knowing how to do these things and not understanding like how to write a business plan or how to like what the best way to treat people is, and they kind of just default to like whatever the kind of easiest route is, and usually that ends up with that dynamic. But also I think that's one of the problems with like this kind of hyper capitalist society that we live in, where the idea that extracting as much value from labor for the lowest amount of cost is somehow this sort of moral imperative. And even if you're talking about a small business, you're still working within that system that tries to take as much from the worker as possible and then aggregate that into as few private hands as possible. So it's just a way our economy and the way kind of we consider business is sort of inherently flawed to screw over the worker.
Tell me a little more about your sort of experience coming up in the industry and that realization, the moment where you said, A, something needs to be done, and B, I'm the person to be involved in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing for me is like I had this like very charmed like unicorn trajectory in the restaurant industry. I basically got an amazing leg in the door at PDT, the cocktail bar, back in 2009, like right when 2008, like right when it opened, and just got right in the right place at the right time, and was around amazing people, and that sort of spiraled into working for Momofuku, and I worked for Momofuku for 9 years as the bartender for a few years, and then I was the bar director for the group, and I opened 10 restaurants for them over those years. And like I said, it's like when you see yourself kind of being the beneficiary of these systems, you kind of can't help but like kind of judge your own kind of complicity and role in that system and perpetuating that. So I think that people who have those advantages and who benefit from structural oppression have sort of a moral imperative to try to disrupt that and to reverse that. But you know, also for me, I didn't think that I would be the person doing this, essentially. Like for me, I wanted to create this organization, and I wanted it to grow out of, you know, sort of my hands into something else that was run by, you know, paid staff who were members of the community that we're trying to serve. And the initial plan all along was that we would slowly grow it, and then we would hire an executive director, and it would sort of take on a life of its own. And you know, I would be there as someone who had the ability to create, you know, not everyone has, you know, the time, the space, and the connections to be able just to start a nonprofit. Like that takes a lot of work and takes a lot of time. So I wanted to use what I had to create something that would sustain itself and kind of grow out of me. Not grow out of me, but that would grow, like kind of outgrow me, I guess is the right way to put it. And this year has just been just this ridiculous acceleration of growth. So we're kind of having the conversations now that about hiring people and bringing on, you know, part-time staff and all these things that we thought we probably have to deal with like in a couple of years, maybe four. But because of, you know, this, you know, this pandemic and the amount of visibility and the support we've had from the community, we're actually able to start to think about those things in a real way, which is wonderful. And so it never really was about me being the center of this. And, you know, it's sort of, it's a function of the fact that, like, when we got a lot of visibility, you know, I was kind of in the center of it. But the ultimate goal is to have it, to support it as a board member, and as a co-founder, and have it really be run, and determined by other people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always curious about that entrepreneurial process of starting something in a fairly, tenuous way that, you know, you have a sort of a vision, you know what you want to do, but you don't know all of the steps involved in getting there. And it sounds like your husband had some expertise that was useful.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
But what were the other points in that process, or what was the learning curve like? How did you figure out the answers to all of the questions that arose as you were starting and designing the organization, you and the rest of the board? How did you figure out those answers?
Trial and error, homework, and also not having the answers. When we were starting, when we were kind of in last year, developing the organization from kind of the concept to something that's, you know, self-sustaining, what I wanted to do before raising money, because raising money is super hard, just as with no track record, was sort of raise other forms of capital. And we wanted to expand our board to 20 board members by the end of 2019, and we were able to do that. And it's a rather large board relative to nonprofits, not super huge, but the reason why we wanted to be around 20 is because I wanted a really good mix of restaurant worker people and nonprofit people. So, you know, I think a lot of times there's a critique of philanthropies in the nonprofit world that they're not always as connected to the populations that they're serving. So I wanted to try to, you know, work against that as much as possible. So having restaurant workers and people who are involved in all levels of the industry, you know, owners, bartenders, coffee people, you know, chefs, to be able to inform the kind of nonprofit people who come from that world, and, you know, how to actually operate in a way that serves the community. And then the reverse of that is to have the people who are sort of navigating this world day in and day out, like nonprofits, 501c3, you know, all this kind of office-y stuff, can then both learn from the restaurant workers and also be able to in turn educate them about how to navigate this world. So it's kind of this like mutual support education project to bring together two really different kinds of expertise to sort of help each other do an even more effective job. So that was a really like something I really felt strongly about, and we were able to do. It's worked out really well because we have a lot of people who are very, very motivated, very hardworking. We're all volunteer board, a volunteer organization for now, and our board's working really hard, and we have, you know, committee chairs. And so it's this really great mix of people. And that allows us to just have a really deep resource of expertise. And I guess one of them, you know, again, one of the many blessings that I count is that I have connections to so many people that are able to help us out and provide us expertise.
Yeah, that's awesome. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay with us.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, and our guest this week is John DeBerry, co-founder and board president of the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation. I wanted to ask a little bit about sort of prioritization of the problems that the restaurant industry is facing, because they are many and interconnected, and you as an organization have established a pretty wide mandate to tackle a lot of different issues in a lot of different ways. And maybe things have changed since you've had such success in fundraising over the last few months. But how have you made those prioritization decisions? Have they shifted over the course of the organization's couple of years since you launched it? How do you decide what the most pressing problems are and how to tackle them?
That's a great question. That's something I've kind of wrestled with since the beginning, is that the mandate is rather broad. And that was something that, as we were, in these very early kind of stages of discussion of starting the organization, we were like, this is kind of like a wide swath of things. Like, maybe we'll kind of tweak and hone and kind of refine, what our focus is. And that's kind of what I was expecting would happen. Like, we would sort of like see great results with, let's say, like mental health or, immigration issues. And that would kind of like, we would sort of like land on one of those things, and maybe some other things that weren't working or whatever other people were doing better, we could let go. But I think that the more we started to think about this, it really isn't one or the other. Like, it's a very interconnected web of oppression that, we see every day. And a lot of it really comes down to economic inequality. And generally, if you're talking about a quality of life issue, the kind of root of it is someone not having enough money, right? You can solve a lot of problems in your life if you have the money to deal with them. So for us, I think it's sort of the reason why we mentioned low wages and career mobility first is because that's kind of like one of the overarching, structural issues in the restaurant industry, is that many, many people are paid almost, like, literally next to nothing. The federal minimum wage for tip workers is $2.13 an hour, which, is not anywhere near where it needs to be, and it leads to all kinds of issues like wage theft and exploitation of workers. And so kind of keeping that kind of always in mind, and then realizing that all these other issues are sort of plugged into the economic issue. So for us, it's been also validating that, in that the kind of the most visible and sort of longstanding organizations that we have been granting to is One Fair Wage, which is working to raise the minimum wage and eliminate the tip credit for tip workers, and they're kind of one of the bigger groups that does this. And so that's sort of a natural kind of honing down to the fact that it's sort of at root an economic issue, but then realizing that it doesn't really end with that. So you have to sort of see how you can approach it from all different angles.
And in your grant making, because I think primarily you've been giving out grants to other organizations working in the industry, right? How have you selected those organizations? How have they found you? What are those relationships like?
That's sort of that's like our bread and butter, right? We wouldn't be able to do that's, if we didn't have these amazing partners to help, support what they do, we wouldn't have anything to do, really. So it's been really amazing over the course of this year, particularly because a lot of these organizations have increased in visibility, or people are starting to form them. But even in the years prior, there has been a really good kind of ecosystem or community of organizations that are working to help workers in the restaurant industry. And our decision criteria is pretty informal. It's not to say it's willy-nilly, but for us, especially in kind of in our startup mode, we didn't have massive amounts of money to grant out, so we weren't necessarily trying to, influence anybody, in terms of like giving grants for a specific purpose. We were just like, hey, we want to support you. Here's $1,000, right? So that was like our thing last year. And just to kind of get the community going, kind of say, hey, here we are, and maybe help people make some connections. And this year's a little different because we have the COVID fund that we set up that has a pretty specific three kind of prongs. And I think that's one of the reasons why people were able to kind of identify with it and why it was did so kind of well in terms of fundraising, is that it really showed people like, hey, we have these three buckets of grants that we're giving. And the largest bucket is basically around half of it's going to the Southern Smoke Foundation, which is an organization that was started by Chris Shepard based in Houston that popped up after Hurricane Harvey. So they've been at this kind of emergency grants to restaurant workers who are facing a crisis. They've been doing that for about 5 years now. So rather than us try to do those individual grants ourselves, we found an organization that we could partner with that was able to do the kind of grants to individuals that we kind of, in our kind of assessment as board members, we thought was the most kind of aligned with what we wanted to do. And they've just been amazing. The people who work there are like literal angels, and I can't say enough nice things about them. And so that's been a really amazing partnership. And then fortunately for us, we acted like we're kind of bigger than we were in terms of like, we had a lot of committees and we had a lot of organizational kind of infrastructure that we had established actually kind of just in the nick of time. We had a retreat in January and we came up with a committee structure and had people volunteer to be committee heads. And we have a grant making committee, and it's led by someone. The vice chair is a bartender based in LA. So again, we're kind of hitting that model of hybrid expertise. And we just do research. We have a lot of volunteers in our grant making committee. We sometimes we'll have a target and we're like, hey, let's focus on New Orleans, or let's look at Nashville, or try and see like kind of any geographic specialization or some kind of programmatic issue, like say mental health or sexual violence or wages. So we usually go into it with a kind of a strategy, but as far as like a super rigorous criteria that people have to go through, we're trying to make it as easy for people as possible, given that everything is so strapped.
Are there particular issues that you think have not gotten the attention they deserve, or that among all of the other organizations that you're working with and supporting, are there issues that have fallen by the side of the road or that are being ignored that you'd like to see more organizations tackling?
Yes and no. I think that there's, to me, the opportunity for progress, if you will, is that there are a lot of organizations that are focusing on the issues that we're trying to alleviate, but they may not necessarily have the focus on restaurant workers, either through just that's just what they do, or they haven't thought of it yet, or they don't have the resources to be able to do that. So one of the things that we thought that once we got big enough, we would be able to work with organizations that were doing, kind of non-specific work, let's say immigration or mental health or gender equity, and say, hey, let's work together and try to address this issue in the restaurant worker population. So to me, it's not so much a matter of there's no one's paying attention to this one thing. I think everyone's kind of paying attention to everything, but just maybe not necessarily everything's all lined up in terms of the issue and the population. So I think that's something that we, as we hopefully continue to grow, beyond this year, that we'll be able to try to make those connections. And at the same time, I think that for organizations that are working on the restaurant worker population, they, like the restaurant industry, tend to be local and rather fragmented and not, kind of massively consolidated in some way, like, the Red Cross or United Way. They're these really informal mutual aid groups that are just kind of getting started and maybe aren't hyper online or very visible. And so for us, we're kind of running on the assumption that it's not that there isn't anybody doing these things, it's just that we haven't found them yet. So we are always, we are very much looking for people to connect us with those people. And we are also actively searching for those organizations as well to kind of help divert some resources towards them.
Yeah. I mean, we're also in this moment of incredible flux, not just in the industry, but as a society, politically. I mean, everything is up in the air. I guess how do you, as you know, as the board president of a fairly young organization, how do you plan for next year? Like, what's going to happen to the industry, I guess? I don't know if you want to hazard any guesses about predictions or anything like that, but I guess more specifically, like, how do you build an organization that's ready to shift as needed?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, really. if you looked at our budget that we put together last year for this year, you just start laughing because it's just so different from what it ended up being this year, both from a size standpoint and allocation. And I think that one of the things that many wonderful things about my husband is that he's really well versed in these kinds of philanthropic nonprofit issues and how to kind of structure an organization. And one of the things that I've been really glad that we did is that we set up, like I mentioned before, these committees. We really like worked as though we were kind of a bit more, like as we were older and bigger than we really were in terms of just like a lot of formal structures that we had set up that we weren't necessarily, working with, relying on, back when we were, raising $10,000, $20,000. But when it came time to test that infrastructure with the COVID relief fund, it worked. It worked really well. We had, people to delegate to. We had people who knew what they were supposed to be doing. And it worked really well. So I think that the preparation is kind of, for me, kind of fun to think about. But I've sort of given up on having any kind of sense of what the future is going to hold, just probably that it's going to be more fucked up than you think it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And the real strategic move is to just be prepared.
Yeah. I want to talk just one more question briefly, and then we're going to do some fun rapid fire questions. But where does your funding come from? Has it been individual donations? Has it been other institutions or foundations? How have you built that side of the organization?
It's been actually both. We are about 40% of our donations, roughly, in terms of dollar amounts, have been from donations of $50 or less. So it's we've got a lot of people who are just giving $10 here and there, and that kind of grassroots thing has been really amazing in terms of just expanding not only just the money that there's coming in, but also the knowing that we're making a connection to people out there who want to help. And so the grassroots side of things has been amazing, and kind of, yes, it's not quite as active as it was a couple months ago, but it's people are still discovering us, and they're still offering their help, which is really wonderful. And kind of in the same pattern has been a lot of people who work kind of adjacent to the restaurant industry, whether they're, knife sharpeners or artists or winemakers or spirits producers, they just sort of poured out, no pun intended. And it's really been amazing. Like we got huge amounts of grants from a bunch of companies in the beginning, like Beam Suntory, Diageo has been really amazing. And we're doing, Elijah Craig is doing Old Fashioned Week right now that benefits us. And so it's just been a really great opportunity to make those kind of institutional connections, to be able to get kind of a more steady source of funding and an ongoing partnership set up. So it's really coming from all sides, essentially. And it's been really amazing to see. I had a 10-year-old mail us a $5 bill. It's really been amazing. And I think it just speaks to how valuable the work that restaurant workers do is to us. And I think that it's possible that many of us took that for granted prior to the pandemic, but then when it's yanked away suddenly and the kind of precariousness of the jobs thrust in everyone's faces, I think it sort of was a needed, but maybe not great sort of wake up call to people. And I wish it wasn't happening this way, but you know, here we are. I think it's an opportunity to say, look, you know, this was a population that was already 2 days away from total disaster. And this is not really the way that anyone wants to live, pandemic or not. And we need to think, about ways to make it structure in a way that we don't have this vulnerability.
Are there ways that you suggest that our listeners who are diners rather than workers within the industry approach eating out now, other than obviously tipping well and being as careful as you can to protect the health of your server or restaurant staff? How should diners be approaching?
Yeah, you know, I really struggle with this because it's, I mean, I think it's, you know, complicated both personally, and I think that also just within restaurants and bars and people who are working there, it's a really mixed bag. But whether or not you're kind of doing long-term harm or long-term benefit by, you know, going out to eat or doing outdoor dining, or and takeaway is probably a wonderful thing to do for, because it's kind of the safest and quickest thing, if that's what you want to do. I think if you're going to go that route, I think that it's best to really focus on a few places and just really support them. You're not going to save every restaurant, but kind of having a realistic kind of scope in terms of like, this is my favorite pizza place, let's go there once a week. Maybe it's not going to be the difference, but it's going to help. I think that's a pretty reasonable kind of strategy for people to kind of wrap their minds around it and not feel like they have to go buy a t-shirt at every restaurant they see. You know, they can kind of try to keep it as, you know, tight as they want to and sort of think about it that way. But then again, it's like, are you endangering people by going out to eat? You know, how is this really working in the long term? And no one really knows. So it's like, it's hard to say like this is a bad idea or a good idea. But on the flip side of that, like, we can't really buy our way out of this problem. It's like, there's just no way the consumer can support this. You know, there's just, the problem is just way too huge. And there really needs to be, dedicated relief efforts on the part of, you know, state, local, federal governments to be able to help the industry ride it out and avoid these massive closures and massive unemployment and poverty and, you know, food insecurity and housing insecurity. It's not something that, you know, it to me feels like it's not really a nice thing to guilt the consumer into supporting restaurants, you know, as a policy position. It's really that if you're a consumer and you care about restaurants, you know, you should really get educated on, you know, what relief efforts, if any, are being carried out by your state, your local governments. They're a lot easier to influence in the federal government, but also know that there's people proposing, you know, federal relief bailouts for the restaurant industry, and that it's really more about, like, you know, we always, Restaurant Workers Community Foundation always wanted to be, you know, based around the systemic change, and I think that that's, you know, nothing if not more true than it was before. But I think in terms of like what people can do who care about the industry is really try to advocate for that systemic change in society, so that we live in a society that can support what's going on right now and that has healthy and happy people who work in restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, it's an impossible question. And I think we know, right? Like, we know that it's always a trade-off of which risk or which danger is more intense. We know that by going out to eat, even outdoor dining, even taking all of the precautions, you know, we know that there's still the possibility that, you know, I as a diner could be putting my server at risk. Right. But also wanting to support the restaurant, also understanding that the server's survival and extended family and anybody else might be dependent on them taking that risk, and wanting to acknowledge the agency that they have in deciding to come back to work and deciding to put themselves in that position, and likewise the agency that we have as eaters to choose to do takeout or choose to only go to restaurants that have outdoor seating or that have taken the regulations, as far as we understand them, seriously. But it's I completely agree with you that it's the wrong approach to put it on on the diner or on the individual restaurant or on the individual employee of the restaurant.
Exactly.
And that there's been, I mean, not even a lack of a response, but just like a lack of recognition of the problem from the federal government, even from the city and the state government in New York, that these half-assed measures that have come up, you know, too little, too late, that have not been thought through, that have been often built on a lot of the systemic problems that face the industry to begin with. It's just been, anyway, as you can tell, incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. It's like, it basically comes down to like, if you live in a society where you have to work to survive, then if you are facing mortal danger at work, you're in an impossible situation.
Yeah, so
maybe we should think about not having that kind of society to provide a basic level of survival to people without needing to, you know, have to, you know, work. Not to say that people just do nothing, but
you should be
a floor. There should be a floor that you shouldn't be able to go below in our society, given how much wealth there is, and the floor is non-existent in our country, and it should be way higher.
Yeah. Yep. On that note, let's do some fucking questions, and then we'll wrap up the interview. How about a favorite fall vegetable? Like, what's the produce that you look forward to this time of year the most?
I'm a big spaghetti squash person, actually. Mm. And I always surprise myself. I'm like, oh, like, you know, it's kind of a pain in the ass. You have to cut it in half. You have to like, cook it for a million years. And then whenever I do it, I'm like, fuck, this is really good. So that's kind of, that's sort of what pops to mind.
How about the best meal that you've ever eaten that cost under $5 or $10?
Oh, that's tough.
Or a great meal that you had that was inexpensive but incredibly memorable.
Okay, maybe I'm cheating a little bit, but back when I used to work at PDT, we worked from, I think, 4:30 in the afternoon until 2, 3, sometimes 4 or 5 at night. And one of the perks of the job was being able to have access to Criff Dogs. And sometimes when you're working a really long time, it's like 11 p.m. on a Saturday, and you order like just a straight up plain like bacon cheeseburger from Criff Dogs, and you kind of scarf it down in like the back, you know, next to the air conditioning units. Like, it's just the most delicious thing you'll ever have.
Yeah.
I guess under $5. So that's just, you know, because it's such a satisfying thing at a time and a place, it's a pretty normal burger, but very fond memories of that.
Yeah. What did you eat for lunch or breakfast growing up as a kid? What were some common meals in your home?
I'm anti-breakfast for myself. I don't think no one should eat it, but I just cannot stomach food until probably like 2 p.m. at the earliest. So, and this has been something that's been an issue for me since I was young, but now I'm my own person. But before, you know, when I was like 12, my mom was very freaked out by me not eating in the morning. And I sort of scarfed down these like spirulina, like protein shakes every morning. That was the bargain. So for me, breakfast, I love breakfast food. And we used to do like a Sunday breakfast with like eggs and bacon and bagels and all that stuff. So I love breakfast food, but the timing is not right for me. But that was the protein shake was my what I had to do.
You started on an illustrious path into some of the best restaurants in the world.
Yeah.
We're gonna wrap it up there. We're running out of time, but where can our listeners find you online? Find out more about your work, buy your book, donate to the organization. What's the best way for them to get involved?
So the Restaurant Workers Community Foundation is restaurantworkerscf, like letter C, letter F, .org, because Restaurant Workers Community Foundation was way too long for a web address. So restaurantworkerscf.org is where you can go to find out about Restaurant Workers Community Foundation in general. And you can look at my website, johndeberry.com. It has sort of my book and, you know, everything else I'm working on. Instagram. Our Instagram for Restaurant Workers is RWCFUSA. It's a great place to go to find out about upcoming events. We do lots of IG Live stuff, and kind of it's one of our main channels to the community besides our newsletter. And then my personal one is JND3001. So that should keep you busy.
Great. And as always, you can reach us by email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can reach, and at yfoodpodcast on social media. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram. You can reach Valerie on Instagram, at Foodie in New York. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind, and thanks to Jess Krangich for being our awesome engineer, as always. And most of all, John, thank you so much for joining me this week and for such an enlightening conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
See you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.